Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Well, we are celebrating 5 years on air with KKNW, with Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and that would be me. So I want to say a quick hi to Eric Ryder, who, of course, is always here in the studio, keeping us ticking along nicely, and say, you know, congrats to you, too, because it's partly through you that we've made it 5 years.
Thank you very much for acknowledging me.
Turn the sound up there, Eric.
Yeah,
that makes a difference.
Do my job. Sure, sure. Yes. And congratulations on 5 fantastic years. Definitely one of my favorite shows, and I think one of the finest programs that we produce here at Alternative Talk 1150. And I'm very proud to be associated with you and your program every week. And we cover such a vast amount of topics and information. But I think the important thing is it's all well-researched. And, you know, you really ask good questions that get to the heart of the matter. So I think it's a great program. And I'm really glad that it's lasted 5 years and hopefully at least 5 more.
Well, thank you, Eric. Thank you. I, of course, appreciate everything that you do, too, because it is a team effort. You know, once I get here and before I get here, I depend on you very heavily. So I appreciate everything that you do, too. I'm cleaning up my little mixes. And so I looked.
Leaving in the occasional just to give it more character.
He's talking last week. He edited a clip for me and he began it with. And I'm like, Eric, we begin a clip with,
Well, I just thought it added a little more character.
Gosh, I know that. I say that a lot. And I don't know why. Why do we say ums and ers? I think I'm trying to give my mouth time to catch up with my brain.
That's
what I'm
doing.
We're
just buying time so we can make that thought.
Yeah, yeah. So I was looking, you know, and I was thinking, let's pick out some goofs, and I couldn't find any of them, though Lord knows I've made millions of them. I'm sure you'll manage to find some at some point. But I did pick out some shows that are kind of resonated, I think, mostly with our audience over the last 12 months. The 260 shows we've done over the course of the 5 years, over 600 guests. I've read over 1,000 books. I've reviewed many, 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 many times that number and chose not to go with them. We've done well over 1,000 interviews to gather research to support that information. And so, you know, it's been a ride and I'm enjoying it. And I thank everybody for listening in every week. And I, you know, couldn't do this without listeners and I couldn't do this without you, Eric. So today, I thought we'd take a couple of shows that have resonated with listeners. And I'm going to get my notes here so I don't goof up. But one of them was one of the things I like to do is talk with ordinary people leading extraordinary lives. That's always fascinating for me. And so I picked a recent segment that seemed to hit a nerve with people in Seattle, LA and New York. Now, maybe this is because they're transient cities. I don't know. But I seem to get most of the feedback I got was from one of those three cities on this show. And I tried to select guests who are making a difference to other people. Guests who are making a difference to our planet, guests who are trying to leave a legacy. I mean, we've talked with people who are doing latest cutting-edge research on neuroscience, heart disease, stroke, celiac disease, cancer, autism. We've talked with surgeons, psychiatrists. We've talked with researchers. We've talked with New York Times best-selling authors and award-winning filmmakers, explorers, mm-hmm. thought leaders, innovative business owners. So it was kind of hard to pick the shows for today.
As well as many locals, which is always a great thing, I think. Local filmmakers, local authors,
yes,
local actors. You know, we've done a lot in that area, and I think that's always great to champion people nearby.
Absolutely.
That are doing these great things,
yeah,
too.
Absolutely. But all of these people have had a good story to share. And so my second guest today are, I'm always asked, who's been your favorite person to interview? And I simply can't answer that. Do you have anything in mind?
Of
the people that we've talked to on the show?
That's a really tough question.
I won't
question.
Put you on the spot there because...
Let me think about it. We'll talk about it after we come back from the break, and I'll give you a couple ideas.
Yeah, well, I can't answer that. But I can tell you that one of my favorite interviews ever, and she wasn't on the radio show, but I've interviewed her three times in print, was Dr. Jane Goodall. And so two of the people that were on the show do similar kind of work to her. They're filmmakers, they're writers, they're storytellers, and they've lived in Botswana for 30 years, and they've been married for 30 years and in love for 30 years. So I selected them as our second segment today. And then the third segment is a woman who went in search of her own secret garden, and when she stopped looking for it, she found it. And she really resonated with our Seattle audience, and that's why I picked her for our third guest segment today. So we've gone ahead and edited some clips from these interviews, and the first person we're going to bring on is Rachel Birch. She's an author, journalist, and editor. She lives in Chicago with her husband, then boyfriend, when she wrote this book. Her book was called, let me get that up here so I tell you right, it was called MWF Seeking BFF, My Year-Long Search for a New Best Friend. And part of this was sparked because I'd had such a huge response from listeners. And part of the reason I picked this was because there was an article in the New York Times recently, just last week, that said once you get to a certain age, it's really, really, really hard to make proper friends.
This was one of my favorite interviews. I could tell you right off the bat. I was having trouble thinking of her name, and we didn't have it listed as she was the author of such and such book. We're looking at the notes today. So, but this is definitely one of my favorite segments you did. Very entertaining. And, you know, it is a real problem that people have these days, trying to make friends as an adult. So I thought her book was pretty insightful in that, and your discussion was quite fun.
Okay, well, I picked out two short clips, and we're going to play those now. So you were about 27, I think, when you set out on this journey.
Right, I was.
Yeah. And what made you decide to devote a whole year to this? I mean, what came first, the book idea or the idea to do this, and then that led to the book?
Right, it sort of happened simultaneously, but first it was this project. I had lived in Chicago for 2.5 years, and I had been thinking about this nonstop because I just kept wondering, how am I going to make these friends? Because I had some friends that I could email, and after two, or three emails back and forth, we could set up a dinner date for 3 weeks later. But I wanted those kind of easy, come over tonight, let's drink some wine and watch some TV kind of friends. And I didn't have that after 2.5 years. And so I realized I needed to really, they weren't going to show up on my doorstep. I had to go out and find them. And I'm someone who does like a project. I like a challenge. It makes it easier for me to kind of force myself to go out and do something. And I've always felt like a year, in college, we used to say, you need the first year is when you find your real friends. At first you have maybe friends by default who live on your dorm room floor, for example.
Right.
And then eventually you sort of find your people. It can take a little while. So I didn't, and a year in retrospect is a pretty short time even to try to, make a new best friend. There's some history involved in that relationship that you can't necessarily get in just a year. But anything shorter would have been hard. So I set myself this challenge to go on 52, friend dates over the course of the year.
Right. And you're very honest in the book. You talk about, sometimes you're embarrassed because you thought you sounded desperate or you didn't know how to approach people. How do I go up to somebody? And, you can't go up and say, hey, do you want to be my new best friend?
Exactly. There's a lot about looking for friendship that feels like dating, except for the fact that there aren't really kind of the established rules and protocol for how to go about doing it. So it can feel kind of tricky, and it can feel desperate because it's totally okay these days to say, I'm looking for a man, I'm looking for love. It's a little bit harder and still a little bit kind of considered a little more pathetic, unfortunately, to say, oh, I'm looking for new friends. When you say I'm looking for a new friend, sometimes people hear, I have no friends, which isn't the same thing.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. You wanted that real connection and that,
right.
Hey, I need you kind of connection.
Exactly.
From time to time. So tell us about how you started out. How did you do? You went on this year-long journey, 52 dates, as you said. How did you decide to approach the first date?
Well, you know, I started out really kind of with the easiest thing I could think of, which was to reach out to my friends and ask to be set up. So again, sort of like dating. I said, I'm in Chicago. I'm looking for some new friends. If you know anyone, you know, introduce me, set us up. I'd love to meet them. So that was sort of the, I felt like that was kind of dipping my toe in the water of friending, as I call it. And then, you know, I wrote an essay that included a want ad, and it sort of said, you know, fluency in Entertainment Weekly, preferred but not required, and waited for people, you know, and I actually heard from a lot of people that way. And then I joined classes and signed up online for kind of friendship websites and did different groups. And then by the end of the year, I worked myself up to, you know, sort of the blind pickup, the giving my card to a woman on the plane or leaving a note for a waitress and saying to people, hey, you know, let's get lunch. But it's hard. It's scary to do that. I had to even when I set myself this challenge, I had to work up to those kind of big moments.
Yeah. I was actually thinking about how, because I moved to Washington State, 12, 13 years ago now, and I knew nobody when I came up here. And so I was thinking about how I met the people that I first became friends with and are still friends with today.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those was a very strange, funny situation because I was at I'll go to a writer's conference because, you know, I'm a writer, I'll meet other writers. And one of the presenters there came up to me and she goes, okay, this is going to sound really weird and I promise I'm not stalking you, because she'd walked by me about four times.
Right.
She said, but I'm married and this guy has asked me to go for lunch with him and I think he has other intentions. Would you mind joining us?
Oh my gosh.
And we're still friends today, you know, 13 years later.
That's a great story. I've become really sort of, I've always been clearly fascinated with how people meet. But now since my book came out about 2 months ago, I've been visiting a lot of book clubs that have read the book and I love doing these author visits. And one of the most interesting parts for me is to hear about how the women in these book clubs met. The other day I was at one, and the girl who started the book club, basically everyone in the club had met because she had put a Craigslist ad out looking for roommates, and she found some, and then she went back to Craigslist and found some other roommates, and all these people basically were there because of Craigslist. And I went to another where the two women who started the book club met at the final Harry Potter film. They started talking about books and realized that they liked the same book, so they thought we should start a book club. So it's been really fun to hear other people's stories of how they met their BFF.
Yeah. And along with the I mean, you have a great sense of humor, and that comes across in the book.
Thank you.
So we'll talk about some of those stories when we come back from break.
Okay.
But I also want to talk about some of the science, because you studied a great deal of science on friendship and happiness and
yeah,
loneliness and all this. So I want to talk about some of that when we come back.
La, 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 la.
Friends do things together.
La 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 la.
Friends laugh together.
Ha 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 ha.
Friends make graphs together.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information. Are you a foodie? Do you love to eat, shop, blog? Do you dream of cooking your way to success? And on another note, what happens when someone at work takes credit for your idea? How do you feel when someone invents something you thought of years ago? And do you have a big idea that you'd like to get off the ground?
We'll answer these questions and more on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair every Monday at noon. We'll share tips, tools, and resources from leading experts to help you think bigger, better, bolder. And we'll hear inspiring stories to help you live well, live strong. Join us Monday at noon Pacific on Alternative Talk 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Body, mind, and spirit. Alternative Talk 1150 covers it all.
Tell you if you've got food on your face. Friends are the ones on whom you can depend.
He's my friend. He's not my friend. Friends are the ones who are there in the end. He's my friend.
And welcome back, everyone. We are listening right now to an interview with Rachel Birchie. Her book is called MWF Seeking BFF, My Year-Long Search for a New Best Friend. Let's continue. So, Rachel, I wanted to talk because on your blog you have Research Wednesday, where you actually share research about the science of friendship and loneliness and all that's good with it. And you actually went to meet with a professor at one point. He made the statement to you that loneliness propels us forward, depression holds us back. So tell us a little bit about what you learned from your visit with him about friendship and loneliness.
Right. So he, as you said, loneliness propels us forward, because I felt very embarrassed to use the word lonely. I felt like there was a stigma, and I didn't want to call myself lonely because I didn't feel depressed. I didn't feel sad. I just was looking for new friends. And he said, loneliness and depression aren't the same thing. And there is a stigma attached to loneliness right now, but you probably are lonely because you've been propelled forward. You've been kind of inspired to do this journey and make a change in your life to kind of get more connected and include more people because you're sort of feeling lonely. And that really struck me because I thought, okay, so it's okay to say I'm lonely. And I think we all sort of feel that way. We don't want to say we're looking for friends. We don't want people to think, oh, she's sitting at home crying all the time. She has no friends, and that can be really tough. Another thing he told me that I thought was really interesting was this idea of sort of not to seem too desperate and too kind of clingy to new friends right away. He mentioned that's a quick way to lose the new friends. No one wants to feel so much pressure that a new friend is just wants to hang out with you every second of every day. It can feel like too much.
Right. Right. And that kind of sparked a memory of reading about somebody that you met via email, and she was about 60 miles away from you. And
right.
You go backwards and forwards by email several times, and then she dumps you on email, as you put it.
Right.
So talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, that happened. And I was sort of, a woman emailed me from my essay, from my want ad, and she felt, and it sort of felt kind of intense to me at first, because she said, we're not best friends yet, but let's pretend we are and let's talk about all these things. And I thought, oh, God, I'm a little nervous about this. I felt the way that he said, someone else might feel about me, like, whoa, let's slow down a little bit. This relationship is moving too fast. But in the end, she actually, before we ever met, emailed me and said, I think the distance is too much for us. I don't think we're going to be able to be best friends. Maybe we shouldn't meet. And I felt horrified. Even though, as my husband pointed out, I was also a little hesitant about the distance. It's hard to be spontaneous when you live 60 miles away. But, the feeling of being dumped by, she wasn't even really a friend yet. And I've talked about this on my blog a lot, because breaking up with friends is such a loaded thing. And, in my case, as I said, we hardly knew each other. And even then, it felt sort of horrifying and embarrassing and hurtful. But I've heard from women, there is research out there that says that women feel more guilt when we break up with a friend than we do when we break up with a romantic partner.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really a touchy subject.
And indeed it is. What do you do if you want to break up with a female friend? I think we do put up more with friends of our own sex than we would in relationships. My next selection, and I chose these two people because they're two of my favorite all-time people that I've spoken with. I love that they are leaving a legacy with their work. A couple of things I took away from this interview was never give up. Nothing's over until it's over. And you'll understand that when you hear the story about the elephant in here. And the other thing that struck me when I was talking with Derek and Beverly Joubert was that I recalled a quote from Dr. Stephen Covey: to live, to love, to leave a legacy. And I think these two are the epitome of that statement. And let me tell you a little bit about them. They are award-winning National Geographic filmmakers. They've lived in Botswana for a long time. They've been filming, researching, and exploring all over for more than 25 years. They particularly cover unique predator behavior. It's resulted in 22 films, 10 books, many, many articles for National Geographic magazine. Their films have been seen by more than 1 billion people. And I talked to them about the Big Cat Odyssey film they just made. They've just made a new one, which aired last week on National Geographic, called The Unlikely Leopard. And it's important because, as we know, these animals are becoming extinct. Cheetahs have disappeared from more than 75% of their range in Africa. There are as few as 50,000 leopards in the open. 50 years ago, there were 700,000. So that kind of puts things in perspective. So let's bring on Beverly and Derek Joubert. You've been filming together for 30 years, devoted your lives to filming big cats. I looked at this film and I had to ask the question, did this work choose you or did you choose it?
Hi, Vicky. No, I think that we went out into Africa to discover the wild part of Africa without really knowing that it would end up filming, being about film. So I think in many ways we evolved into it.
That is so true.
You said that you are based in Botswana. That's where you spent most of your time. You said it feels like the end of the world, Derek. How so?
Well, you know, the world is now so full of clutter and noise and opinions and people. It's the one place where you can go and be right at that edge. You know, I think philosophers and poets forever have needed to go to that silent place. And for me, Botswana and the Okavango Delta is that silent place.
Mm-hmm. And Beverly, you say it's extreme living in the middle of a swamp, very poetically put, but you say it is home and it just feels right.
It truly does. I must tell you that when we have to come on these trips, it is very hard to drag ourselves away from that wilderness. And for 28 years, we've lived in wild places. We've explored them. So we have excitement in our veins and adventure. And we're trying to discover what we don't know about these areas and about the cats. So it's the extreme part, though, is that we have many challenges. And the challenges are from the tiniest little amoeba in water to mosquitoes. And then, of course, crossing those major rivers where we really don't have man-made bridges. We only have one that is quite wonky. But after that, it's the unknown. If the buffalo are going one way and the lions are following, we follow behind them. And often we don't know what's underneath our wheel. And at times we have, put the vehicle into a major hole and drowned the vehicle.
I can imagine. You say that in the film that you chose to film the particular lions that you filmed because they were bigger, slightly bigger, but they had two unique characteristics that drew you to them. They hunted a lot in the day, and they hunted mostly buffalo. So I wonder if you'd tell us about that, because it's a little different to how I had thought of lions before.
Well, yes, we'd come out of the northern part of Botswana, Sabuti and Silinda Reserve area, where the lions are generally nocturnal hunters. So 90% of what they hunt up there is at night. And then we flew over this area one day and looked down and went, wow, what's going on down there? We got on the ground sometime later and discovered this whole new almost race of lions that are swamp cats that are moving through the water, which, you know, all cats hate water generally. But because of that constant forging through the water, they've developed these huge chest muscles. And they're about 15% bigger than other cats that we've known. And for some bizarre reason, they're hunting during the day. Now, we can't explain that because lions generally have small hearts, which makes them more efficient when it's cool. But maybe the water's helping. But these cats are hunting during the day. 90% of what they hunt is during the day, and 90% of what they hunt is buffalo. So quite a challenge. A whole lot of circumstances that made it fantastic for us.
Yeah. Now, one of the things you said that in your early days of filming, one of the questions you were interested in, Beverly, was why do hyenas sometimes so easily win the fight over food? And why sometimes do lions win? And there was a very simple answer to that that was hidden behind a mane, as you put it.
Yes, that's so true. And that was in the early days where we were doing this extreme nocturnal work, starting at 4 in the afternoon and working right through until 9, and 9 in the morning. And, of course, it took us a couple of years before we actually understood exactly why it was happening. And it really is that territorial male. When the lionesses are feeding and have made a kill on feeding, often a clan of hyenas, and the clan of hyenas in that area would be 20 to 40 strong, would easily be able to take over from 6 lionesses. But as soon as that male came in, he is much bigger. You know, his weight is much bigger. And then, of course, that mane is displaying as he's running in. And they would respect that. And often, just him coming in roaring, they would run off. But then, of course, we produced a film called Eternal Enemies, and we talk about this in Big Cat Odyssey as well, in that where the male started hunting down the hyenas whenever he was in the area, and often he would target the matriarchal females.
Yeah, interesting. Because you say, as you point out in the film, we often do think of males as the regal showcases, or as even being lazy because they're lying there while the female gets their food, but their true worth comes out at night then.
As it is with all males, Vicky, it's a bit of time.
Derek, one of the things you said in the film was that every piece of the tightly bound fabric of life out there, you see it as just another piece of the big cat puzzle. Talk to us about that a little, if you would.
Well, exactly. You know, if you look at a piece of African bush or forest or savanna, it's very complex, and there are a lot of things going on, but at the very, very core of that is a big cat. The grasslands of the Masai Mara are driven by these big cats. The entire migrations across most parts of Africa are driven by the threat of predation. Almost every situation, and definitely every ecosystem we look at, is driven by its big cat. And the real danger is if you take these big cats out of the system, the systems themselves start to collapse, and so they're vitally, vitally important.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the hunting situation out there, because the big cat population, as we know, is drastically dwindling. I think you pointed out in the film that leopards and lions are down by 95%. Where does hunting fit into this now?
Well, safari hunting still plays a major role in that. If you think that they're now, you know, the lion numbers have gone in our lifetimes from 450,000 to about 20,000. But even it's even wrong to focus on that number, because of that 20,000, there may be 3,000 or maybe 4,000 male lions. And as we go out and we target those male lions because they're the biggest and they look glamorous on a wall somewhere, we're slowly knocking down, in fact, rapidly knocking down the genetic strength of those of those species, lions in particular. And about 550 of those 3,000 lions that are left, about 550 of them come into the United States as trophies each year. So clearly this is not sustainable, and it's playing a major role.
Yeah, it's hard for me to imagine why somebody would want a lion's head stuck on their wall, but I know it does happen. But what other threats do they have?
Well, each one of the threats at its most basic description is human conflict, or humans at least. So hunting is taking out a big chunk of the gene pool. A conflict with cattle, around cattle, so lions, certainly in areas of East Africa, going out and hunting cattle because there are now so many cattle in Africa. And then there's a retaliation from herders, villages, tribes. In West Africa, it's slash and burn, basically chopping out the forests and creating less and less habitat for leopards. man again. And of course, we've got 7 billion people. And every time we add another billion people to the roster, all the big scary predators of the world, from crocodiles and sharks and lions, leopards, tigers, all halve in number. And so while we're increasing, they're decreasing rapidly.
And then, of course, there's still some cultural belief that animal parts are going to be healing. And that's happening both in Africa and in Asia. So a lot of the animals that are poached are used for some medicinal purpose.
Right, right. Now, you talked earlier about the hunters seeking out the stronger animals. So I'm assuming that weakens the gene pool at some point. But you also talked about an interesting story in the film where sister lions were attacking sister lions and eating cubs. And for 6 years, I believe, there were no cubs that survived. What was going on there?
You know, we don't know, Vicky. The thing about that now is that we've lost over 100 cubs in that time. And the females, for some reason, won't let their sisters breed. And it might well be a function of the fact that they're on a small island. And indeed, if we'd added 100 more lions to that system, it would have been overcrowded anyway. But it seems unnatural. And I think that it's possibly an indication of what happens when you put a species under pressure. They behave in a very weird and unpredictable way.
Mm. I have to say, this is one of the most beautifully filmed pieces that I've really seen. I mean, we expect that from National Geographic, sure, but it really it made me see things a little differently. And one of the things that's always hard for me, I'm one of those people who has to shove a pillow in front of my face when animals attack one another. And you dress
do this. Anything you wouldn't know if it was well filmed then.
Well, this one I was peeking a bit. My dog was playing up. He was hearing the sounds and wondering what was going on. But you were the first people to film an elephant kill. And it was difficult to watch. I did watch this, but it was also very inspirational at the end. And Derek, I think you said you were struck with a realization when you saw that nothing is over until it's over. And Beverly, you said you wanted to scream and shout and tell it to run away. Talk to us a little bit about what it's like to... I know this is part of the law of nature, part of the food chain, but what is it actually like to sit there and film this?
Absolutely. It is emotionally draining, without a doubt. And especially when you also put into fact that we had tried to film that over a 10-year period. We'd heard it happening in the darkness, and each year through the window of opportunity was this intensely dry period just before the rains. And so already our emotions, you know, were just on the edge. But to witness something that you actually can affiliate to, especially an elephant, you know, has breasts like a woman up front, and their eyes are so similar to eyes, and you feel that there's an immense intelligence in an elephant. And then all of a sudden to have 8 lions trying to bring this elephant down is incredibly hard. I remember it was a very disturbing night for me. I had tears rolling down my cheeks, and I truly wanted to send some form of encouragement to that elephant not to give up. But you can't. You know, witnessing something so unique that the world had never seen, and this is nature playing out its game. It's not up to us to play God with nature. So we did. We carried on filming very professionally, although I must tell you, we were totally drained at the end.
Yeah, I remember Derek saying it was the emotions were being tossed around like passengers on a small vessel there. So, Derek, you had said in the film, you mentioned that lions live in a violent world, but they're not malicious. Talk to us a little bit about that, if you would, because I've heard people say that they feel cats are malicious, but in the lion, in the big cat category, that's not true.
Well, it's definitely not. I don't think it's true in any cat category, in fact. And I think that in time that we've tried to distinguish and understand how man is different from the other animals, and it's certainly not in language. I mean, animals have their own language. It's not in emotion. We're now finding out that animals have emotion, or altruism and all these other things. But the one thing that that we do claim exclusively as ours is a certain capacity to be malicious. So lions jumping on an elephant, definitely violent, and there's no doubt about that. I'm not quite sure what the category of cruelty is, but certainly they are killing these things to eat. When you see a cat playing with a mouse, it's practicing to hunt, and that also is not malicious. Mm. But we are the only ones that go out and bomb each other because we don't agree with a religious belief or even the color of your hair. So that's exclusively ours. It's nice to have something that's exclusively ours, I suppose.
even if it's not a good thing. There was a point that your lives were changed. You changed from being conservationists and filmmakers to becoming big cat advocates, and that happened when a leopard you were filming adopted for a while a baby baboon. I wonder if you'd talk to us about that.
You know, we had a period with this little leopard. She was 8 days old when we met her, and her mother basically led us to her den. And so we really got to know this little leopard intimately and spent 3 years filming this little leopard. Through that time, with them being solitary creatures and never having any backup but themselves, they had to, hunt for the cub and protect each other. It was remarkable that this little leopard started to accept us in her world. And through that period, we managed to capture scenes that in the 28 years that we were filming, we never ever saw before. And that this scene that you're talking about is one of those scenes that was totally unique. It's never been written up in science, and I think that's what is so wonderful about Derek and I filming out there. It's the complete unknown, and we're open to any form of discovery.
Right. So talk to us a little bit about what you're trying to do with the Big Cats Initiative. I know this is inspired by you and your work. National Geographic is supporting it. What is your hope that this will bring?
Well, the first thing is to have... we're delighted that National Geographic are dedicating an entire week to this on Nat Geo Wild, because what it does is it focuses people's attention on this. I think that the real problem with all big cats and lions in particular is that we just think Africa's full of them. They're so visual and they're so iconic that we think there can't be a problem with lions, surely. Somebody should be taking care of it. Well, the truth is that we're not. We're not doing a fantastic job of this. And so National Geographic giving us this week to talk about it is fantastic because it's about awareness. But the truth is we have to go further than that. We have to take action. And we started the Big Cats Initiative where we are planning. We've got an action plan. This is an emergency action plan. If we don't do something about these big cats now, we will see extinctions by 2020, 10 years from now. And that's got to be all-encompassing. That's got to be buying land around the national parks, creating corridors. It's got to be compensation for cattle where lions kill cattle. We've got to step in. We've got to have a dialogue with the Maasai. There's got to be, early warning for when lions are heading towards villages. We have to do basically an entire menu of things to try and stop the conflict between man and these big cats, otherwise they will be gone soon.
And this really is an emergency intervention. It's saying take action now, otherwise we will see the decline of these cats and we will move into extinction.
I can't imagine that that even people sitting in the middle of America or Europe or Australia even, who never will have a chance to go to Africa, I can't imagine that these people would be comfortable knowing that big cats disappeared from Africa.
And Africa has the highest poverty rate, and it really will deflate the country if we take big cats out of the system, because 80% of the tourism is really going to go on a safari, and of course they want to see the most iconic animals being the cats.
Yeah, definitely. You said at the beginning that you saw your work as
no more than a celebration. And now you've come kind of full circle on that and say, maybe you were right at the beginning. It does have to be about celebration and respect. And I know people can find out more about your cause at causeanduproar.org. A final lesson that you'd like to leave with us from the Big Cats?
Well, I think that's really what it is they are these complex and really interesting gems out there in Africa. And we need all sorts of cooperation. We need participation. We need ideas. Everybody has to join together to try and figure out a way that these things do not go extinct in 10 years' time.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you both being with us today. Fantastic filming, fantastic work. I know billions of people have seen your films and, you know, great, great work.
And I can't say enough about their work. Truly, I am so impressed with everything they've done. If you want to find out more about Derek and Beverly Joubert, you can just Google Derek and Beverly Joubert, and that's spelled J-O-U-B-E-R-T-S. You can go straight to the NationalGeographic.com site and find them there too. When we come back, we're going to listen to a clip from an interview I did with Anne LeClaire. For every action we take, every movement, every thought, there's a ripple. She's done much more than create a ripple with her work. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Feed your mind and your body and spirit will follow. Alternative Talk, 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. We're celebrating 5 years on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair on KKNW today. Looking back at some of the clips of the past year, you let me know that Anne LeClaire was one of your favorite authors. She wrote a book and she talks about the power of silence. Her book was called Listening Below the Noise. When she was a kid, she wanted to be an FBI agent or cowgirl. Instead, she raised a family, worked as a radio broadcaster, an actress, and a journalist, and a correspondent for the Boston Globe. She finally quit to follow her dream of writing books. Let me bring on Anne LeClaire. I wanted to begin, Anne, by looking at how all of this began for you 17 years ago. You say that as a child, your favorite book was The Secret Garden, and you were forever looking for that secret garden. And one day in 1992, in middle age, you found your own secret garden. I wonder if you'd share with us what that's all about.
Certainly. And it's interesting because, as I said, as a child, I was completely fascinated and enamored with that book. And my grandfather lived in Boston, and I was always looking for a secret garden. And it was when I stopped looking for the secret garden that it came to me in that way that sometimes happens in life. I do live on Cape Cod, the other side of the country from you. And I was walking on the beach one day, thinking about my friend whose mother was dying, and watching some eider ducks, those beautiful black and white sea ducks, dive for food. And they stayed underwater so long, I tried to pattern my breath with theirs and couldn't do it. These ducks with lungs the size of my thumb were able to stay underwater longer than I could hold my breath. And that struck me in that moment as a miracle of nature. And you know, Vicky, when we're in that moment of like gratitude and appreciation, how it can just open us.
Mm-hmm.
And I was suddenly overwhelmed with gratitude for the beautiful place I live, for my life, for my family and my friends, for my work. I just love writing, and I'm so fortunate that this is, you know, the thing that I love most is what I do for a living. And I was just in that moment, because we know everything can change in an instant, in one doctor's phone call and one test result and a car accident, anything. It can all change. And in that moment, I was just grateful for that moment and the riches of my life. And I was grateful even for the sorrows I'd experienced because I understood how they had made me who I am too. And I was so grateful. I said out loud on the beach, I am so grateful. I don't know what to do. And a man behind me on the beach said, sit in silence.
Oh.
And when I turned around, there was no one there. And it was such a profound experience that nothing like that had ever happened to me before.
Right.
Or I must say since. But it was so real and profound, and it was a voice outside my head. It wasn't like I heard it in my head. That I was struck by it and began to wonder what sit in silence could mean, and finally decided maybe it means just what it sounded like, be quiet. So I came home and told my husband I wasn't going to talk the next day. And that next day happened to be a Monday, and I did not talk, and it was such a truly, that even that first day, transformative experience that I knew I needed to do it again. And I did not know on that day I was beginning a practice that would continue to this day. But since that time on the first and third Mondays of every month, I do not speak. And in the beginning, it was just that. I did not speak. And, of course, over the years, it's deepened and widened. And the original title I had thought of using for the book was Stone Falling Through Water.
Mm.
Because of the rip. When a stone falls, it goes deep and changes things deep in the water, but it also sends ripples out, and it felt to me that that's exactly what silence has done in my life.
Yeah, amazing. Now, there might be some husbands listening out there thinking, boy, I wish my wife wouldn't talk a couple of times a month. but this, you know, tongue-in-cheek I'm being, obviously. But this is has been a very powerful, transformative experience for you. I'm wondering if you'd share with our listeners, your husband was a little skeptical when you decided that you were going to make this a regular practice.
Well, he was. I mean, you're right. I often hear that response about, oh, how can I get my wife to do that? But he didn't like the idea. He said, and I think it is about being unavailable in some sense. And he said, what if my friend Margaret's mother was dying? And he said, what if Margaret's mother dies? And what if the children need you? And I said, I don't know. I don't know, but my intention is to not speak. And he didn't like it for a number of years. As he said, it was inconvenient, and it is. We're used to living in a certain way. We're used to having people available for us. We're not used to claiming any time, especially nowadays, I think, mm-hmm. where there's what I like to call a false urgency to our lives, where we think everything is immediately urgent. But after 5 years, one Sunday night, my husband said to me, you know, I didn't used to like your day of silence, but it has taught me something I need to know. Most things aren't that important.
Isn't that interesting?
We go through life thinking everything's important, everything's critical, and it's kind of all around a certain sense of self-importance. And by maintaining silence, I was able to strip away what truly isn't important and kind of prioritize what is.
Right. Well, there's a story that you share later in the book when your husband Hillary appears at your studio door and you're writing. And he says to you, I'm going to the post office. Do you need me to pick anything up? And you totally lose your train of thought, which one does when one's in a creative flow and somebody's interrupted. And there's a great quote that you use to illustrate that point. Henri Matisse once said, whoever wishes to devote himself to painting should begin by cutting out his tongue. And you quip there, or somebody else's, meaning your husband's. So, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut over you.
Well, I think, many, many artists and poets and composers have talked about the need for silence to create. And that certainly is one of the discoveries that I found, that on my silent days, my writing seemed to go much deeper. I would make connections because, in my mind, silence equates space. I mean, it's just as simple as that. And giving ourselves space to be, to sort things through, to think about some of the big questions that we really do need to think about to live a full and rich life, we don't often have that space anymore. And when there used to be, a Sabbath honored, that created space. when we did, when there weren't as many technological advances and it wasn't email and text messaging and voicemail and all of that, it created kind of a space for reflection and a space to deepen certainly creative work. And that was one of the great early gifts that came to me around the practice of silence, was this space is very, I mean, I think we might think of silence as being kind of a deadened space, but in fact, it's quite lively. And that space certainly changed my writing. It also, in a way that surprised me, I thought early on that perhaps silence would disconnect me from others, but in fact, it proved to be the river that connected me to others.
Oh, I love that, the river that connected you.
In one way, because in silence, not talking, I began to learn to listen.
So you do have communication. Do you sign communication at all, or do you really try to refrain from engaging?
That's an interesting question, Vicki, because engaging is such a rich word, and there's so many ways to engage. My preference has been to keep the silent days pretty quiet, not go out. But in 17 years, and especially in a life where I teach abroad, I teach in this country, I often am traveling. So I am out in the world on silent days. I do have a card that says I'm having a day of silence. And I will nod, you know, smile. I think someone or scientists have shown that 80% of communication is nonverbal anyway.
Right, right.
But I try not to write notes unless they're absolutely mandatory. For instance, if I'm traveling and at the airport need to tell the ticket clerk something, I'll write it. But I, generally speaking, refrain from writing and kind of stay in this kind of bubble of silence. And it's just proved so valuable in so many ways, not the least of which is that it's enormously restorative. And it's very pertinent to us. I mean, it's pertinent because the level of noise that we live with now, noise of all kinds, is damaging to our mental health and to our physical health.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you say that in the beginning of the book, you say over the years you'd had many years of, or many times where you had accidental silence, but to take it purposely, to be purposefully silent, created a whole new level of focus and understanding and that restorative power that you're just talking about. Anne LeClaire is my guest, and her book, again, Listening Below the Noise. I want to ask you, Anne, about the story you share in the book. You ran into an Iranian-born writer who's been living in exile in Paris for a number of years. And he says to you, you talk about silence with passion and love, but it's easy for you. You're a middle-class white woman in America with a nice family and home. And you said, yes, his words irritated you. You felt chastised and judged. But for women in the East, he continued, silence is not so nice for them. Silence is a punishment. It's a means of suppression. How did you feel hearing those words?
Well, at first I just was defensive, but then I actually allowed them in. And then I wanted to talk to him more about that, because I knew if I was going to be writing about silence, it was important to write about all facets of it. And while my experience had been very, very rich and beautiful, for many of us, silence is not necessarily a positive. I mean, we've all experienced at one time or another that kind of icy or punishing silence. And Rezar told me that he had been in prison, and silence had been used as punishment, and to such an extent that they welcomed, and I thought this was so chilling, they welcomed even the sound of the footsteps of their guard, even though they knew it would mean they'd be tortured. At least there was sound. And that was probably the most dramatic experience that I have heard of the effect of the negative effect of silence.
Mm. Now, as you practice this, you've been practicing for 17 years, as we said, as your practice deepened on the first and the third Monday of every month, you found that your desire for solitude actually increased, that you desired it more. And you talk about going from speechlessness to solitude. What was the shift there for you?
Well, I think getting very comfortable in silence. I mean, there's a reason we run from silence in this culture. I think we tend to believe that we need noise and excitement and addiction to be fully alive. We've come to believe that, when in fact, to be fully alive is to be at peace in our own skin, in quietude, and we need to reclaim ourselves, and then we can give ourselves back to the world. And like the monk Thomas Merton, I found the more I actually sat in the quietude and got to know myself and found the peace there, the more I wanted it.
Well, that wraps today. Three guests from the past year that I wanted to bring back and share with you that I particularly enjoyed, or you have let me know that you've enjoyed. We just took some short clips from them. I'll be back next week with an all-live new adventure show. Please join us then. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.